Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Douglas Wolk, whose book is Reading Comics, How Graphic Novels Work and What They Mean. You're a journalist. You're starting a new column at New Republic, which we'll talk about.
Yeah.
You've written for the New York Times, Rolling Stone. But your first love was comics.
It was, pretty much. I probably started reading comics when I was 8 or 9 years old and just never, ever stopped. It's been my companion and my bad habit ever since.
This is, in so far as I know, one of the only books that deals with this entire new field, which you call art comics in particular.
Right.
People have called graphic novels. I think it was Will Eisner who invented the term, or he used something else?
The term graphic novel, nobody's exactly sure where it came from. The first uses that anybody's found come from the 60s, and people were talking about a potential new form of comics. Eisner wasn't the first to call his book a graphic novel, but he was really the first to get attention for it. And that was A Contract with God and Other Tenement Stories in 1978. As the title suggests, it's not actually a novel. It's a linked group of four stories. And ever since then, the term graphic novel has come to mean pretty much anything that looks like a comic book, but that somebody wants to, you know, raise the prestige level of a little bit.
Which you call art comics to distinguish, I guess, from the commercial superhero comics.
Yeah, I mean, art comics, the distinction is partly a matter of ownership, who owns the content and the concepts, and it's partly a matter of, is this meant to be mass entertainment, or is it meant to be, you know, the sort of romantic ideal of an expression of the artist himself or herself.
The idea behind the book, Reading Comics, is that this is a specific art form unto itself and should not be confused with any art form and needs to be treated seriously as its own art form, which doesn't seem to have happened thus far.
It's happening occasionally. It's happening some. I don't want to kind of make a claim for the legitimacy of the medium because I don't want to make a claim for the legitimacy of any medium. I think that there's a strain in the culture around comics of, please respect us, we need respect, please respect us. You know, the way you get respect is just sort of do something worthy of respect and then don't act surprised when you get it. I don't really care if comics get more respect than they have already. I'm happy if it comes. There are people who are doing it already. You know, come join us. I also have a problem with the idea of comics being literary, and I'm putting quotes around that literary, air quotes, you know, the famous radio air quotes. I don't think that comics are a literary form in the same way that I don't think they're a culinary form. They bear some resemblance to literature. They have spines, they have pages, they sometimes involve words. They don't necessarily have to involve words, but they sometimes involve words. They're experienced in kind of a similar way, but to think of comics as a new form of literature or a different form of literature is to think of them as prose literature that happens to have pictures attached to it. And that's really missing a lot of the point, I think. I think the distinguishing characteristic of comics is that they are drawn. They're not just images of something. They are drawn images. That's what carries the narrative. You can get into the Scott McCloud, you know, is it sequential or not argument all you like, but they're drawn. That's really what comics are.
It's a form that, as you said, deals with, from the drawing perspective, symbolic abstraction,
right,
distortion. An image without text means a pause. Text means that's the amount of time it's happening. Longer sequence requires some kind of scrutiny. All of this is what it is. It's something else.
Right.
And it goes back to what? The Bayeux tapestry or something?
Oh, it can go back to, you know, somebody making two drawings on a cave wall. But there's not a specific point at which comics before that point didn't exist and after that point they did exist. They just kind of gradually came into existence. And again, I think it's distracting to try to think about where the actual origin point is. Like, they're there now. They've pretty much been here for a while. They've kind of sort of been around longer than that.
But it all began in a mass media sense, I guess, in the United States with the arrival of the superhero comics, pretty much, in the late 30s.
You could say that, but before that there were newspaper strips going back
right
around the turn of the century. Winsor McCay, those amazing Little Nemo and Slumberland strips, and the Yellow Kid, R.F. Outcault. Yeah, again, there's not a specific origin point that you can point to. There's no secret origin of comics.
It grew after the superheroes and really began to become something else, I guess, in the 60s with the arrival of Marvel, or is that just because that's when I began reading it?
Everything begins when we reach consciousness. The superhero comics became different in the 60s because of Marvel, but it's easy to forget now that superheroes have this absolute hegemony on the comics mainstream, that they used to be just another genre. There were romance comics, there were horror comics, there were humor comics, there were funny animal comics, and occasionally you'll see a little bit of that now, but mostly it's superheroes, 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 and that there's this complicated and sort of boring historical process that led up to that. I think one point at which things really started changing was in the late 60s, especially actually in the Bay Area, with the arrival of the underground comics, as they were then called, which were owned by their creators, which were usually the work of a single cartoonist, or at least a specific piece was the work of a single cartoonist instead of being done assembly line style, which did not have to be entertainment for children or pretend to be entertainment for children, even though they were still sort of riffing on, you know, ideas that were entertainment for children. They could do whatever they wanted with them. And that gradually expanded, you know, through the 60s and Zap Comics and Robert Crumb and the Freak Brothers and all that into the 70s when you started seeing projects like Arcade and Art Spiegelman started doing work and Harvey Pekar started doing work. And by the 80s, you got into Raw Magazine, and eventually by the mid-80s, there was an economic structure in place and also an aesthetic structure in place for cartoonists to really have some chance of cartooning whatever the heck they felt like and following their own personal muses and having some vague hope of potentially someday making a living at it. And that's continued pretty much up through the present day. And now, you know, right now is kind of a golden age for comics because there's so much amazing stuff happening, so many incredible cartoonists. It's, you know, a little cartooning renaissance.
Douglas Wolk, the book itself is divided into two sections. The first section is kind of a theory and history. The second section deals with individual artists of your choosing because they're the ones you're into, and that's fine. But there's a few things left out, one of which, of course, is comics that are European or Japanese.
Yes.
The other, which I found a curious gap, it struck me, or it strikes me, that one of the reasons that we're living in a golden age of comics right now is because it started in the 70s, but really took on 10 or 15 years ago, the tentpole comic book movies transformed how people observed comics. It sort of brought them into the mainstream. The use of material like Ghost World, Sin City, American Splendor suddenly transformed the art comic into a mass commodity through Hollywood. You don't really discuss the relationship of Hollywood to comic books, but I think it's significant in what we're seeing now.
Yeah, it is definitely economically significant. I went to Comic-Con International in San Diego a few weeks ago. 140,000 people there, crammed to the gills. Amazing. Absolutely everybody in Hollywood had to be there.
2 years ago, how many would have gone to one of these conventions?
2 years ago, maybe 100,000.
Okay, and how about 10 years ago?
10 years ago, oh, I don't know, 30,000, 40,000? You know, it's jumped. And one big difference is, yes, all the big Hollywood studios are there. All the video game companies are there. And there's this feeding frenzy going on right now for comics as properties to turn into movies because they're things that have already demonstrated that they can be interesting in kind of a visual narrative way. And, you know, a friend of mine at Comic-Con, my friend Steve Lieber, 10 years ago he drew a book called Whiteout, and now Whiteout is going to be a movie with Kate Beckinsale that's opening in a couple of months. And he said, yeah, I'm the only person at this convention who's promoting a $40 million motion picture and a $2 mini-comic. That's sort of where comics finds itself in relation to the movie industry right now, you know, on its knees praying that Hollywood money will come save it. At the same time, there's this idea going around that every little comic book wants to be a movie when it grows up, which I think is really kind of pernicious. It doesn't follow that a good comic will become a good movie. League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, whatever. You're also starting to see a certain number of people who are getting into comics because what they really want to make is movies. I interviewed a well-known film director who shall remain nameless in San Diego who said, yeah, so I had this great idea for a screenplay a while ago, and so I went to my friends at this comic company, and they said, wow, that sounds really interesting, but do you think you could give some of the characters a little bit of superpowers, and we'll do it as a graphic novel first, and that will really help you sell the screenplay? And he said, I thought that was a fantastic idea. So, yeah, you know, I, you know, ramped up their power levels a little bit, and so we're working on the screenplay and the graphic novel at the same time, and there's a studio in India that's drawing it, and I'm not really sure, I haven't really talked to any of those people yet, but it's going to be awesome. And I was thinking, like, oh, my God, make it stop. Make it stop. Make it stop.
If comics are selling to this degree, why haven't we specifically seen beyond Fantagraphics a major company putting these things out and putting them in a Barnes & Noble and
Drawn
Amazon?
Quarterly, First, Second, there are other companies that are jumping on the bandwagon now. I mean, Fantagraphics has a deal with W.W. Norton for distribution, and it's a distribution matter. At the same time, Drawn & Quarterly now has an affiliation with another big traditional New York publishing house. First, Second is affiliated with Holtzbrinck. That's why and how they're getting into bookstores. When the Sin City movie opened, a lot of bookstores started setting up graphic novel sections because there was a demand for it, and they started ordering, you know, Sin City books and then other Frank Miller books and then other things that Dark Horse Comics published and then other things that other companies published. It's been this gradual accretion. Manga has really opened up the bookstores too. It really, really has.
Why did you decide not to include manga in reading comics?
Essentially because I'm not a manga expert. I've only read a few things, and the same reason I didn't include a lot of European material. I don't want to pretend to be an expert in something that I only know a little about. And I didn't want reading comics to be a comprehensive book. I wanted it to be a subjective book. I wanted it to be something that didn't try to be a definitive text. I wanted people to be able to argue with it. As far as what I chose to talk about in detail, they're not the canon, they're not the best comics, they're not the most important comics. They're stuff I thought was interesting at the time. There'll be another book.
In reading that second section, which deals with particular artists and writers like Alan Moore, Chris Ware, Eisner, Spiegelman, Frank Miller, a couple of women, Alison Bechdel and Carla Speed McNeil, there's a huge amount of self-indulgence with what seems to be minimal self-editing, lots of self-loathing. There's kind of a subtext where you're criticizing those very elements without really saying it.
In the cases where I do say it, I do say it. Like in the case of Chris Ware, there's a sense in which I love Chris Ware. I think he's a brilliant cartoonist. I think he's a brilliant draftsman. But a lot of what he's making us pay for is watching him beating up himself. You can apply the idea of self-indulgence to essentially any fine artist.
Not in the case of an artist.
Right.
But in the case of a literary writer, there's usually an editor behind there who can kind of point and say, hey, you know, this isn't working. I notice, for instance, the dream logic of these materials is very little that's straightforward. A lot of that is really difficult to swallow unless you're really trained to swallow it.
Huh. I had not really thought about that. I mean, I'm thinking about an example of somebody like Alison Bechdel, amazing, amazing book, Fun Home. It's not a linear narrative. It's not straight chronology, but it's very, very carefully organized. And again, that's something that it was subject to an editorial process. She worked on that book for 7 years, draft after draft after draft of the text, of the arrangement, of the way she was drawing everything, of the degree of photorealism or distortion with which she was drawing things.
In reading this, I found a propensity among these artists to use their dreams because they follow dream logic. It seems that these read more like dreams than stories.
Give me some more examples of that. I'm not sure what you're...
Cerebus.
Cerebus incorporates some dreams, and certainly, you know, David B's Epileptic incorporates some dreams. But what Epileptic is really about is the development of David B's own drawing, of his hand, of his drawing style, and how that came to him as a result of his experiences and of trying to work out what was in his head through drawing. So it's a memoir, but it's a memoir of his style. And part of that comes from, you know, the images that he saw in his dreams or that his brother described to him.
Grant Morrison?
Grant Morrison's stuff involves a lot of straight-up surrealism, but also involves a lot of fractured narrative, of stuff that actually does fit together into a coherent story. He just makes you work to get at it, to figure out how it's all fitting together. And one thing that a lot of these art cartoonists do is they come to comics as a way of explaining what's going on in their heads. And sometimes there's some really interesting stuff going on in their heads. There's also a certain number of kind of boring art cartoonists who don't have a lot going on in their heads, but they're not really the people I was so moved to talk about necessarily.
You're listening to an interview with Douglas Walk, whose book is Reading Comics, Politics in the Comics. Mm-hmm. You've done political reporting. I always had thought that putting aside the superhero world, right, art comics were generally leftist, but they're not.
Not necessarily. There are certainly some fairly right-wing art comics. One of my absolute favorite cartoonists, Dave Sim, is way, way, way off to the right. I think he's a phenomenal cartoonist. I think he's an amazing mind, and I disagree with him on just about everything. And I think that's one of the things that makes him important to read, the fact that he does articulate this way the heck out there right-wing point of view so passionately and so beautifully in its way. And that makes it in a way more interesting to argue with, more interesting to take on. In terms of politics, I think one thing that's kind of interesting right now, even in mainstream superhero comics, is that there's a lot of comics that are addressing current politics in a metaphorical way. And one thing that I think comics are really, really good at is extended metaphors. Sometimes they're more explicit than others. There's a comic that's running right now called DMZ. It's a science fiction story. It's set a few years in the future in Manhattan. There's an American Civil War going on. You know, one side's got Jersey, the other side's got Long Island. It's about an embedded reporter in, you know, this bombed out Manhattan. And it's completely about Iraq, which is mentioned nowhere in its pages. It's about embedded reporting. It's about propaganda. It's about, you know, information war, siege mentality. It's about war journalism. It's a really interesting way of getting at that. If you want to go a little further out, there's this miniseries going on right now called World War Hulk. It's a straight-up superhero comic. On one level, it's about guys in tights beating each other up and smashing Manhattan in the process, and it's a beautiful example of that. And it's also completely about blowback from Iraq. It's about the American political process right now. That's all the subtext, but it's there. You have to look a little bit, but it's so there.
Someone once said that the golden age of science fiction is 15. What's the golden age of comics?
When comics people use the term the golden age, they usually mean a technical term. They usually mean like comics published between 1938 and 1955 or 1956. I'm making the slightly provocative, you know, it's a poke argument in the book that the golden age of comics is right now this minute.
And what about the golden age in terms of an age of the reader?
It really depends. It used to be that, once again, the golden age of the comics reader was 12. Now we're seeing people who are coming to comics in their 20s, in their 30s. They're coming to comics not from having read Mad Magazine and Batman when they were 12. They're coming to it because they have a design background or a fine arts background, and they've gotten interested in narrative and in things that can't be done in a single image. You know, you're starting to see some people for whom, like, the golden age of a comics reader is 28. Or 32, or 35.
Let's talk a little about some other political issues.
Yeah.
Sexism in particular. Mm-hmm. There are very few women, as you point out, though that's growing. In June, you published a piece in HuffingtonPost.com concerning images of women and the size of breasts, and you got some very intense complaints about that.
It was a hot-button issue. It still kind of is. In mainstream comics, a lot of mainstream comics are not just aimed at adolescent boys and overgrown adolescent boys. They're aimed at them in a way that hangs out a big sign out front that says, "No girls allowed," and probably misspells girls. Again, that has to change, and it is changing, and if you want to get all capitalist for a moment, market forces demand that it will change. What you see when you go to comics conventions, the reason that there are so many more people now than there used to be who come to the big shows, well, it used to be 90% guys. Now it's like 55-60% guys. Sandman, you know, these breakthrough comics that started drawing women into comic stores as forbidding and scary and creepy as they sometimes were, cracked open the gates, and all of a sudden people realized, huh, new market.
There's also the backlash, because suddenly the women are looking at some of these comic books and just astonished about the victimization and the porn.
Victimization, porn, but also, you know, cheesecake. There's just a lot of stuff that is somewhere in the territory between unconscionably horrible and ew. That has to go away, and it'll go away eventually. I hope it goes away sooner than later.
Are there New Age comics, Christian comics, gay comics? There are.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. In the same sense that there's New Age film and Christian film and gay film. What's a gay comic? Is Fun Home gay comic? Kind of is. It's entirely about Alison Bechdel and her father, and they're working out their sexual identities.
And she's crossed over into the mainstream at this point?
There's mainstream and then there's mainstream. I believe Time Magazine named Fun Home their book of the year last year. Like, not graphic novel of the year, but book of the year, book of the year. Yeah, maybe that's mainstream. That's great.
Well, Douglas Wolk, you mentioned something that scares you about the entire field, and that's what Hollywood is doing to it in a negative way. And I could see eventually it's going to wind up, as everything else is, being ground down by the corporate establishment. Do you see comic books, art comics, surviving this in a positive way?
Oh, absolutely. Art comics will survive as long as two things apply. Number one, there have to be people who want to make them. Number two, it has to be financially feasible for them to make them. I think that the first has been true for a really long time, and the second has been true for a little while and is not going away. Again, the economics of the comics business are a little bit strange, but essentially, if you can sell your comic to a few thousand people, then that means you have an audience for it, and you can get by on that.
Yeah, one thing I was thinking of in reading the book and thinking about the translations, Gulf's World turned out great, and so did American Splendor. But on the other hand, when Frank Miller's two pieces came out, 300 and Sin City, the film seemed to show the shallowness of both pieces of material.
There are people who love both of those movies. I don't really love either of those movies, but I don't really mind them either. One thing that both of them did was try to approximate Frank Miller's drawing style, to get what originally came from his hand through a pen onto paper, onto film. And you can't really do that and expect it to translate. One thing that worked so well about Ghost World, which Dan Clowes, who drew the original comic, also co-wrote the screenplay, it didn't try to approximate the look of Clowes' drawings. It didn't even try to get the plot exactly the same. You know, the major, major character in that movie is not even in the book. It went for the tone, and it got the tone right. I think that's something. I think Charles Burns is currently involved with adapting his own book, Black Hole, which is a book that I love. Again, that's so much a product of his hand that I don't know how it's going to translate unless they take some very different tack with it. I could be surprised. Watchmen. Everybody's psyched about the Watchmen movie coming out 03, 06, 09, I believe.
Well, but you also say in there you find it, you think it's pretty much untranslatable.
I think it's totally unfilmable. I think there's no way to turn Watchmen as it is into a good movie. Maybe the people who are making the movie have some really smart idea about how to turn it into something that works as film. Watchmen as a book is so much about being a printed object that's a comic book that has design elements on every page, and you can flip forward and backward. You know, there may be somebody who's read Watchmen all the way through in one sitting at some point, but I can't imagine how. What's exciting about Watchmen is not that it's a thrilling adventure story, even though it kind of is. It's stuff that you can only do aesthetically in its medium. People think, you know, oh, it's a comic book, it's got pictures, therefore it's already visual, therefore we can make a movie of it. Like, yeah, but you're going to lose a lot there. And, again, one big thing you're going to lose is the drawnness. A Watchmen movie will no longer be drawn by Dave Gibbons.
Alfred Hitchcock used to storyboard all his movies.
Right.
How do you think a storyboarded movie would look as a comic?
I've seen a few of those, people who just sort of take their storyboards and they're like, oh, here's a comic. Like, yeah, but you're not really taking advantage of what you can do here, in the same way that if you want to, you know, do a novelization of the movie and you just, like, write down all the scene descriptions from the script and then stick quotation marks around the dialogue, you're not really getting a novel.
Douglas Wolk, let's change gears for a moment. I want to talk about your new column. How did you get this column in New Republic? It's called The Critical Browser, Literary Analysis of the Political Web.
Yes.
How'd you get the gig?
They called me up and said, would you like a gig? It actually is a comics thing. From last year May to this year May, there was a weekly superhero comic book series called 52 that I decided, just as a five-finger exercise, I was going to write a blog about every week at 52 Pickup. Is the name of it. If you Google 52 Pickup, you'll find it. So I wrote, you know, 1,500-word, 2,000-word essay every week about the superhero comic, whether it was any good or not, whether that week was interesting or not, just trying to think of something to say. And there's a new web editor at the New Republic who really liked 52 Pickup, and he said, do you want to do some sort of similar close reading thing for the political web? And I've written my first two so far, and I'm really enjoying it.
What exactly are you doing?
I'm looking at political things on the web, and a political thing, deliberately broadly defined, it could be anything. The Obama campaign's blog on the Obama 08 website, the talk page for the Wikipedia entry on the Valerie Plame business. I'm analyzing them as literature, giving them, you know, literary close readings.
It's only going to be online, though.
As I understand, yes.
And what are you planning to do after that, once you get your feet wet on this column?
I write for a lot of places. I think I'm writing something like five different columns in five different publications
now. What are the other ones,
then? Let's see. There's a monthly column about graphic novels and comics in Salon.com. There's a monthly column about punk rock and alternative rock for eMusic.com. There's a bi-monthly column about album cover design that I do for a print magazine. There's probably a couple of others, and I'm not even remembering them right now.
Final question to you. Yeah. People out there who are listening to this, some are familiar with comics. Most are not. If they were going to start, putting aside the old superhero comics, many people have read them as kids and then stopped reading them at a certain point. Where among modern comics, if you wanted somebody to start, a good place, and they're really not familiar with how to read them where would they start?
It's a hard question to answer. The one way of answering it is to say, go to a good, dedicated comic store and just look at the shelves and see what catches your eye. So much of comics is about what they look like that if you look around, you'll find something that looks interesting to you. They're very, very immediate. Pick stuff up, page through it, see if it's you. You'll be able to tell very quickly if it's your kind of thing. If it looks like it's not your kind of thing, it's not. That said, there are a couple of books that I keep handing to people that make them come back 2 days later and say, like, you have any more like that? One of them is Fun Home, which I mentioned already. One of them is if you're interested in just sort of like a straight-up exciting like adventure horror story, there's this book called Death Note, a series of Japanese books. There's a guy named Kevin Huizenga who published a book called Curses a few months ago that is beautiful and not really like anything else. If you're interested in Victorian literature, I hand people the first volume of League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, which was, you know, the basis for a terrible movie a couple of years ago, but it's so much fun to read. There's so much stuff out there. It's a great time.
You've been listening to an interview with Douglas Walk, whose latest book is Reading Comics, How Graphic Novels Work and What They Mean. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.